Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and food is a political issue. I'm not talking about Atkins diets and that kind of thing, but if you were listening last Friday, you heard us talking about how contentious the debate over calorie labeling here in New York has become, right? And since today is the final day of the Chinese New Year celebrations, not to mention the 90th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, it's an appropriate time to discuss revolutionary food. And I'm not talking about cutting-edge cuisine like mango anchovy ravioli foam. No, when I say revolution, I'm talking Chairman Mao, whose politics radically changed not only Chinese society, but the Chinese kitchen. My guest right now is food writer Fuchsia Dunlop. Her latest book, Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, Recipes from Hunan Province, was recently published by Norton. Fuchsia Dunlop, welcome to WNYC.
Hello.
You write that food, cooking, and eating habits are the mirror of society. We all know that. And no more so than in China, you write, a country and a culture that has always had an unusual preoccupation with food. What do you mean, unusual preoccupation?
I think anyone who goes to China knows how obsessed Chinese people are with food, how they love to talk about it and they love to eat. But also it's been, you know, in the distant Chinese past, the emperors made offerings to their ancestors. People feed their ancestors as well as their families. And you have this long kind of preoccupation with food. You know, Chinese philosophers used it as a sort of metaphor for all kinds of things.
Right. Well, I've read that the equivalent phrase for how are you in Mandarin is qi fan le ma, or have you eaten? I guess that speaks volumes.
Yes. Yeah, the traditional greeting sure is.
Certain dishes were banned under Mao. Kung Pao chicken, for example, was deemed politically incorrect during the Cultural Revolution because it was associated with an imperial bureaucrat. So did it actually become a crime to prepare or to eat certain foods?
I don't think it was actually a crime, but just sort of certain names became politically incorrect. So you had a lot of the sort of old, grand old bourgeois restaurants, and in a revolutionary era, they were given revolutionary names like the Red Flag Canteen or the East is Red. And it was the same with dishes that, you know, no one really wanted to be seen to be serving a dish that was associated with an imperial governor of Sichuan. So they changed it to just chicken with chilies.
Right. So the dish didn't, I mean, you know, you can get Kung Pao chicken now under that name for free with an order of $20 or more from many corner Chinese takeout places. It was the same dish, but it was renamed for a time?
Yeah, just for that period of political madness in the Cultural Revolution.
You also write that the killing of oxen was prohibited because they were needed to work the land, and there were restrictions on the keeping of pigs and poultry because they consumed grain that could otherwise feed the poor. Did this work to feed the poor?
Well, I think, I mean, it was just sort of part of the appeal of the early communists, you know, that they were coming to power in an era where you had terrible corruption among the elite and devastating poverty and even famine in some areas. And so one of the appeals of the new communist movement, particularly in Hunan, which I wrote about, was that they were sort of saying, you know, we will protect the interests of the peasants and doing things like redistributing food. And the oxen thing is very interesting because that was something throughout Chinese history. You know, really in the ancient past, there were periodic edicts banning the slaughtering of oxen because they were needed to work the fields. So it was a kind of revival of a much older practice.
And I don't know if this is outside of your realm, but did it work?
Did it work? Well, I think certainly, you know, in the early days of communism, there was a feeling that life was getting better and that there was greater equality and that the sort of the wealth of the landlord class was being redistributed. You know, of course, it was to go sour later on, but yes. Certainly in the early days, there was this great feeling of optimism, yes.
And you write about something else that's so fascinating from that period, and to many people listening who may not know that this was the case, it's going to sound horrifying. First, in 1956, private restaurants were nationalized. Then, in 1958, a period that was known ironically as the Great Leap Forward, private food production was banned. Does that literally mean you could not cook in your home?
Yeah, I mean, there was a, you know, in the countryside, people were reorganized into communes, and you were meant to live communally and share all your farming equipment and your possessions. And they actually organized these kind of communal canteens in villages. You know, you can still see in some villages the houses, the big houses, which they used for the communal canteens. People were supposed to eat together. And in many places, they even took sort of cooking implements and melted the metal down in this futile attempt to make steel. And so people did have to eat in communal canteens. And you can imagine how unpopular this was, you know, in a society where we've already said people love eating and cooking for the family is kind of the basis of society. So it's remembered as being a really awful period with disgusting food as well.
Right. So it's ironic that we're talking about the influence that, what you know, the Communist Revolution had on Chinese cuisine, when one of its most profound effects was the starvation of its citizens.
Well, yes.
But we can take some phone calls for Fuchsia Dunlop, her new book, Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, Recipes from Hunan Province, published by Norton. And I wonder if we have some Chinese immigrant or Chinese-American second-generation listeners who know about this era from your own family or anyone else with a comment or a question, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Did the cuisine and the cooking rules of that period affect traditional medicine, those Chinese who practiced traditional medicine because diet is so closely linked to health?
It's not something I've specifically studied, but I think you can safely say that the Cultural Revolution really affected all aspects of Chinese society and things that were seen as being traditional, feudal, superstitious were very much frowned on. So any kind of practice which carried the taint of feudalism or superstition, you know, people would be very careful about showing it. You were supposed to be sort of modern and communist in your actions.
Right. I was reading a really interesting article from The Hindu, a newspaper in India. It was relatively recent. Their correspondent was traveling in China and marveling at the difference between Indian and Chinese cuisine. And the article said, while in India, elite Brahmins delineate their status by increasingly pickier food choices, no meat, no garlic, no onions, no non-vegetarians in the kitchen. In China, the greater the variety of things you can afford to eat, the greater the variety, the meatier and the weirder, then the higher your status.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I think one of the funny things that I've noticed traveling around the Chinese countryside is you have a lot, you know, in the period of the famine that we've mentioned, people in the countryside who were literally starving and they were desperate. They would eat anything. They would eat all kinds of wild vegetables and wild herbs and things. And now, because they don't have to, now they like to eat kind of proper vegetables and meat. And all these kind of wild plants, like wild ferns, jue cai, for example, are no longer eaten by villagers, but they're sold onto the cities where sort of gourmets will pay a lot to eat them.
Right. And one of the things that's so interesting about Chinese food is the names of some of the dishes, you know, pockmarked mother chen's bean curd or numbing and hot chicken. Sometimes it almost feels like truth in advertising taken too far. Did Chinese dishes always have such stark or flatly descriptive names?
Some of them do, but of course, you know, numbing and hot chicken, for example, sounds a bit terrifying, but numbing, the word that it translates is ma, which refers to the delicious lip-tingling sensation of Sichuan pepper. So in fact, it's not so horrifying when you like eating Sichuan pepper.
Seems like a lot of the traditional banquet dishes have more elaborate names, like Snowy Wonder or Ants on a Tree. They sound like exactly the type of dishes that would have been in Mao's crosshairs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just that, you know, in China, haute cuisine, wonderful cooking, is kind of culture. It's part of a sort of cultural conversation. And so the serving of the food, the presentation, as well as the ingredients, and of course the name you give it is all part of that sort of cultural activity. So you do get beautiful names, you know, referring to gold and jade and so on, and auspicious, lucky names for New Year dishes as well.
Fuchsia Dunlop, my guest on WNYC, her new book, Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook. And by that, you do mean from the revolutionary period, correct?
Yeah, well, I think for years I've been fascinated at the links between social history and diet. And in this book, I've tried to reflect that with sort of dishes from different eras. So you'll find, like, you know, one dish that was popular in the restaurants of the late Qing dynasty, others associated with nationalist officials. And then, of course, you know, the communist peasant cooking, some of Chairman Mao's favorite dishes and so on. So trying to reflect that period of history. And of course, Hunan was Chairman Mao's home province, and not only his home province, but it also produced a lot of other sort of famous military and political figures. So there's a kind of link between Hunan itself and the revolutionary tradition.
Brian in Freehold, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just marvel at how different, when I was young, I had a babysitter who was first generation born here. Her parents immigrated from China, and the food was so different than what she would bring over and prepare for us than what you get in the average, quote-unquote, American Chinese food experience. I mean, I marvel at how wonderful it was. Never had Chinese food that good since. And I think most Americans don't really experience the real deal.
Can you give us one descriptive example?
I remember everything being very light, not a lot of oil, which a lot of people do complain to me about when they don't like Chinese food. Crispy, delicate, all sorts of different wonderful things that it's such stark contrast to the American diet that I was used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've ever experienced it since.
Brian, thank you. And Fuchsia, sounds like the Hunan cuisine you know.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that struck me when I first went to China and on every subsequent visit is how wonderful and diverse Chinese food is and how really little it is represented in the West.
Here's one email that says, one man's kung pao is another man's freedom fries. And another with a question that says, is Hunan cuisine represented in anything close to authentic form in Hunan restaurants in the West?
Well, for example, in London, there's now a little Hunan restaurant opened by some people from Yueyang in northern Hunan, and it is pretty authentic. But I have to say that most other Hunan restaurants that I've been to are kind of using the name of Hunan to give themselves a bit of individuality, but they actually don't bear any relation to the food that people eat in Hunan today.
Patrick in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I had heard some discussion of using the potato or yam as a sort of food ingredient when during times of economic stress, and the fact that many Chinese don't really regard rice as really the main thing in their diet, and I was wondering if you had any comment about the mango of Mao.
Well, certainly about, I mean, I think with rice in South China, I mean, it is the central diet. And, you know, if you say you eat a meal, you say chifan, eat cooked rice, literally. With other things like potatoes and sweet potatoes, they were actually traditionally sort of grown in areas where you couldn't grow rice, so more mountainous areas. And also people would eat them, you know, in times of famine. Rice was always the preferred staple food, and only if you were very poor or lived in a difficult area would you eat potatoes actually as a staple food.
What did Mao himself like to eat? Is it documented?
Well, yeah. In fact, I've met the chef who used to cook for him when he came back to Hunan and also had lunch with his nephew in his home village, Shaoshan. And there are certain dishes that he liked very much, and it is well documented. The red braised pork, great chunks of belly pork simmered in a sort of caramel dark sauce with spices. Very delicious. And also sort of simple stir-fried vegetables. It's quite interesting that even when Mao was sort of at the top of his career ruling China, could have eaten anything, by all accounts, he went on liking the kind of hearty, rustic food of his childhood.
Richard in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Richard. Richard, are you there? Oh, I have to do this. Sorry. Now I got you, Richard. I'm sorry. My fault. You're on.
Yeah, I was just commenting that in the period of 57 to through about 60, 62, there was this collectivization, mostly which was done to maximize the taking of grain and food product from the peasants because of Stalin's deal with Mao on industrialization. But after the Cultural Revolution failed, I started doing business in China in 80. You saw a flowering when I went back, because I had a delegation here, one of the first delegations I helped host in New York from Asia. And you saw sort of a whole flowering of local cooking, because China, most people don't understand, China in those days, most of the people in individual cities speak their own language. They could read Chinese, and a few would speak Mandarin, but it'd be like Chicago's would be speak Chicagoese, and they cook that way. So you had this enormous variety suddenly beginning to flourish.
Does that sound right to you, Fuchsia?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly in terms of, you know, as you say, you know, regional dialects. And we often forget when we talk about Chinese food that it is this enormous country. It's more of a continent than a country. And these different areas, they have a very strong identity reflected in the dialect, in the opera, in the character of the people, and also in the food. And that's the most striking thing about traveling in China for a foreigner, if you like eating, is just that, you know, wherever you go, different province, different city, often different town or village, they'll have their own specialities to eat.
So did Deng's economic reforms of the 1990s affect Chinese cuisine? Has it rebounded and changed again from the Mao days?
Absolutely. I mean, I studied and lived in China in the early sort of mid-1990s. And in that period, you still had this sort of aftermath of the Cultural Revolution. You had these kind of rather staid, state-owned restaurants with terrible service, drab decor, and often rather indifferent standards of food. And now the great competition in the market economy, and there is this resurgence in Chinese gastronomic culture. And I tell you, some of the banquets that I've had on my last trip to China, they're unbelievable. The artistry, the food, the ingredients, it's really stunning, and you do have the sense that they're recovering, you know, a lot of what was lost in the Cultural Revolution.
And these mega restaurants that can hold 1,000 people, I read.
Yes, unbelievable. I mean, there's one in Hunan that I know, which I think they have something like 4,000 covers. It's more like a citadel than a restaurant. You just wouldn't believe the scale, with all these different dining rooms for different kinds of food. And, you know, these places, you can have restaurants with 1,000 or 2,000 covers that are full, with people queuing outside in the evenings.
And not surprisingly, I guess, we saw your article in the Financial Times from 2005, where you pointed out that the children of today in China are being raised by a generation of parents who experience famine and therefore tend to indulge their children in a way that they themselves could never have experienced. So we've got less than a minute left. Today is the last day of the Chinese New Year festivities. Is there something traditionally served on this day?
Yeah, you should eat yuan xiao or tang yuan, sort of glutinous rice balls, often with a sweet and sticky stuffing.
And knowing this, we put a link on our webpage to one of your recipes. It's called Mr. Lai's Glutinous Rice Balls with Sesame Stuffing. And it can be found on the Brian Lehrer Show webpage, as well as in Fuchsia Dunlop's book, Revolutionary Chinese Cookbook, Recipes from Hunan Province, published by Norton. It's been a fascinating conversation, and you made me hungry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Chuck Schumer in conversation with several New York swing voters on the issue of property taxes and education. That's tomorrow. A lot to listen for every weekday at 10 a.m.